Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I am your host, Mikhail Carter. Today, I have the pleasure to speak with Dr. Diane Stewart about her book, Black Women, Black Love, America's War on African-American Marriage, published by Sill Press. Dr. Stewart is a professor of religion and African-American studies at Emory University, specializing in African heritage religious cultures in the Caribbean and the Americas. Welcome, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mikhail. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So let's get right into it. So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, often in the academy, we say that our teaching should feed our scholarship as much as our scholarship should feed our teaching. And I would say it was the former. My teaching really fed this scholarly project. Back in 2004, I taught a course called Black Love for a number of reasons. As you noted, I'm a professor of religion, trained theologian, Black liberation and womanist theologian. What am I doing teaching this course on Black Love? Well, it was about all kinds of love. So we were reading people like Howard Thurman and Martin Luther King Jr. and June Jordan and bell hooks and Audre Lorde. But I included a section on romantic love. And at that time, I was focusing on heterosexual coupling and marriage, and I was floored by what the stats were telling me. I was totally floored. I don't know why, given that I knew what the position of Black women are in our society, vis-a-vis coupling, dating, marriage, but something about seeing it in black and white, right, in sociological materials that have been out there for some time, just reading it made me begin to look at the problem more deeply as something systemic and structural. Our public conversations about Black women and love or Black people in love are focused on self-help. They're focused at the personal level and the individual level. And I understand that because we feel the issue of romantic love and coupling very personally, right? That's how it operates. It operates at the personal. But when we step back and look at the wider issue as it impacts the Black community nationally, we really do have to ask questions about systems and structures. Certainly the sociologists had done that work, but their works were in sociological studies, right? Written for peers in the field, not written for public audiences. Some historians have begun to write great pieces on love and marriage during slavery or in the post-emancipation period, but no one had pulled it all together and looked at it historically across an arc that brought the best and most current research to the question of what's happening with love and marriage for Black people. And I noticed, particularly a lot of men in the public arena, instructing Black women on what they should do to make themselves more marketable in the marriage market. And I was thinking, we're missing the boat. You know, Black women, you know, lose weight, take the bass out of your voice, stop being so bossy, think like a man, act like a woman, you know, all of that. And I just said, we're missing the point here. And so I felt that I needed to write a statement, especially after teaching the Black Love course several times over. In returning to the materials and updating, I just felt I needed to write a something that would take us from the slave ship to social media and show the structural underpinnings of what I end up calling forbidden Black love.
Thank you so much for that. And so, yes, so your book definitely does make a statement. And so, as you mentioned, you talk about or actually introduce forbidden Black love as one of the most unrecognizable civil rights issues. So could you talk to the audience about what is forbidden Black love and then how is it, you know, an unrecognized civil rights issue?
Sure. Again, we focus on marriage in very personal and individual ways, right? Among our friend groups and, oh, you know, he proposed and now we're working on the wedding and what we focus on it. It's a very personal experience for us. No one wants to take that away. But if we were not clear that marriage is a civil right, all we have to look at is what the LGBTQ community has accomplished, right? Or, you know, hopefully, you know, continuing to accomplish over the past couple decades, right? It is a civil right. Marriage is a civil institution that is regulated by the government. In fact, Black people gained the right to marriage, were given the right to marry in 1866 with the 1866 Civil Rights Act. So it was a right that we had to be given because when you are enslaved and you're governed under the laws of property, right? Property does not have rights to marry, right? So we had to be given that right. And I think it's important to kind of remember that, right? To remember that we're dealing with a regulated civil institution. And what's really ironic, Mikkel, is that since the late 1880s, the Supreme Court has ruled on over a dozen cases that reaffirms marriage as a civil right, as important to the health and happiness of American citizens. And yet, and even with the case of Loving v. Virginia, for example, in 1967, where the Supreme Court rendered unconstitutional any miscegenation laws across the nation, right? So we have Blacks having the right and whites having the right to marry interracially and others, anyone in America having the right to marry interracially. And yet we are now in a situation where Black women, millions of Black women, can't even marry intraracially as a result of structural and systemic problems. So it is a civil right. And I argue that this civil right is being denied from Black women and men, but Black women at much higher rates than being denied this civil right in this country, right? I'm arguing that it is denial because of the historic, systemic, and structural issues that make marriage and coupling and love impossible, difficult, or delayed. That's really how I define it. Those systemic and structural issues that make love, coupling, and marriage impossible, difficult, or delayed for millions of Black people in this country.
Wonderful. And I think you did a great job at proving that argument and demonstrating how these like several structural factors have contributed also to like the decline of Black marriages. And so also in your work, you reveal like how these issues can be traced back to slavery, as you mentioned. So can you talk about how slavery was the first battlefield, like you said, the first battlefield in the war on Black marriage? And then also, can you give the audience, I guess, a glimpse into some of those disheartening stories that you uncovered?
Oh, yes. So I talk about four major infrastructures of forbidden Black love. And I start with the slave ship and slavery to analyze them. So the first is a separation of Black marriages and families. And so because we know the average age of African females on slave ships was 15, most of these women and adolescent girls would have been either belonged to extensive family kin networks and been married themselves, right? And so oftentimes what we see are people being separated on slave ships, moving in different directions from the rest of their family, especially spouses and their partners. So the separation begins there. It begins on the west coast of Africa and on those slave ships. But then we certainly see it in America, in the institution of slavery, especially now. Before the ending of the international slave trade, you know, the outlaw of the slave trade, which really took effect in January 1808 for the Anglophone world, we did have family separation. Definitely, we saw family separation. However, after the outlawing of the international slave trade, we saw such an incredible boom in domestic slave trading, the interstate slave trade in the United States, that close to 1 million people were moved from places that they knew as home, deeper south and further west, as a result of trying to meet the growing needs of slavery in America. So as some historians have pointed out, like Tara Hunter, you know, while many couples actually did marry during slavery, so many of those couples were torn apart. They could not have stable marriages, in part because of the domestic slave trade. And another thing that we must consider is, in many cases, we also have couples who are working on different estates or different farms in different, either in urban areas away from their spouses. In the North, this was true, that kind of the domestic landscape of gendered labor often separated women from their spouses, from their male spouses. And the same thing could be true in the South. You commonly could find spouses who lived on farms or plantations a mile or miles away from one another, or spouses who would be hired out even if they weren't sold for you know, years upon years, and could barely, if ever, even see their families, their spouses, and their children. So that's one. Another is racist and sexist jurisprudence, policies, and legal transactions. And I have a host of examples I can give for that. But I'm going to go on and name two others: sexual and reproductive violence and control. The violation of Black women and men, adolescent girls, and likely adolescent boys. We don't see a lot of data on that, but we're learning more and more about the sexual violation of African descended males as well during slavery. And I know this is a lot of binary talk, and I think the non-binary community has made us aware that not everybody does identify as male and female, and I understand that. So sometimes I should probably say persons, but it's really important to understand, as Alexis Wells Ogogombe says, that the Black woman's womb was a capital asset. And so her reproduction of a labor force, of an enslaved labor force, was important. And that led to massive rapes of Black women by their slave owners or their slave owners' children, and other whites of authority that might have been in the work environment. The forced reproduction of enslaved Black women and men and adolescents, the forced reproduction, having them copulate to produce what slave owners thought might be the most healthy and powerful laborers that could help yield more produce, more capital for their industries and for their bottom line. And then, as a result of the sexual and reproductive violence and control, we have to talk about colorism and phenotypic stratification. That CPS, as I call it, has a significant impact on the Black dating and marriage market today. And we have to deal with the way colorism entered our communities during slavery, how mixed race children were often treated, were often privileged during slavery, and the impact of that on the Black community's internalized colorism and phenotypic stratification, and how we value persons based on skin color, how CPS impacts our the psychology of beauty and desire in the Black community. That's another, I think, underlying structure that inhibits Black women's ability to marry and have healthy, loving relationships as well. So I can go into some more of those more, but I just thought those are some of the ways that we have seen forbidden Black love unfold during slavery. And then we see these phenomena repeating themselves in new ways, in different ways across the centuries.
For sure. And so you also speak about like the different policies as a way as well. And so you reveal how strategic and calculated factors such as welfare policies and mass incarceration cultivate lead to the disappearance of like many Black men. And so can you speak about how factors such as these affect Black marriages and Black love today?
Yes, for sure. There's a, you know, it's really interesting. When I got to the period of welfare in the book, because of course, you know, after slavery, I work on Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction, right? Post-emancipation. And we're dealing with widows of Civil War veterans who are being denied their pensions. Dealing with lynchings, and I'm looking at lynchings from the perspective of love, marriage, and family, not just from the perspective of the horrific violence, but the trauma it causes and what the removal of a loved one who might have been a very important provider for the family can do to a family, both materially, psychologically, and emotionally. And we have to think about those who were likely lynched but disappeared, and families never even knew what happened to their loved ones. So dealing with that, and then talking about how many Blacks, millions of Blacks, moved out of the South as a result, right? And so what happens as millions of Blacks are moving north to cities like Detroit and Chicago I wanted to say Missouri, but that's a state. But moving north into these big cities, and finding themselves in tenement housing, in these meager, menial, dilapidated kind of communities and neighborhoods, they are struggling and suffering. And so when welfare benefits begin to open up to Black women, because of course, initially, they were reserved for deserving white mothers, and they were called mothers' pension programs in the 30s. But when they do open up and Black women begin to join in massive numbers in the late 50s, early 60s, that's when we begin to get these austere policies, literally, men in the house, literally, there is a policy, men in the house, substitute father and suitable home. So Black women and men's sexuality and domestic cultures were policed and punished by the welfare state. It's heartbreaking, the kinds of experiences that people have. And social demographers will note that we don't even know the full percentage of Black men in this country, because many of them are hiding, even till today. So many Black men, we have situations where Black women or Black families were told, I'm thinking of one where there were 12 children in the family, and they were told they could move out of the slums into these new housing projects. But the one stipulation was that the father would have to leave the state. I mean, this was absolutely unbearable. Can you imagine? And the family decided that in order to escape poverty, this was the best possibility. And I, having grown up seeing the movie Claudine, which kind of, you know, publicized these policies in the motion movies, for all of us to see in the 70s, I knew about these things. And I was thinking, oh, this might be just old hat and people are going to be like, yeah, we know all of this. But I find so many people who say, I had no idea. I had to go back to my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and ask, do you know about this? And they're like, absolutely. So they would, the other thing that welfare departments will do across the nation, they would hire, they would actually work with social workers. They would have social workers who would come into people's apartments and come at any time of the night. Surprise people looking for two toothbrushes in the toothbrush stand, right? That adult toothbrushes, looking for men's slippers, looking for shaving cream. They would open people's washing machines and open their stoves and their ovens and make sure that they're not storing men's things in there. Looking also for items that would seem impossible for someone in welfare to have. Oh, you have a new iron. You have a new television. Where did you get that? Maybe a boyfriend is also supporting you. So the idea was the patriarchal American state made sure after slavery that Black men would be responsible for Black families. We are not going to be responsible for indigent women and children and able disabled elders. You able-bodied Black men will be responsible for all of that. And so if we're giving you welfare and you're getting support from a man, we have to subtract what that support is from what we're giving you. So this common misperception, and this happens today, the common misperception that, oh, welfare is free money. First of all, if we look at someone like Johnny Tillman, who was a welfare activist that I featured in Chapter 3, the whole chapter kind of unfolds around her story and the stories of some other women. But if we look at Johnny Lee, she was working in the cotton fields of Arkansas since the age of 7. She worked as a laundress for over 20 years. She had worked for, I believe, almost a decade before she even went on welfare. So she had been paying into the system of welfare herself. And an illness, a surgery, led her to decide that she needed to monitor her children some more. They were adolescents now, and she couldn't work the way she did for the pennies that she was getting. And so she began to accept welfare benefits. And it was as a result of that that she realized how abusive and traumatic this system was for millions of women. She didn't just work for Black women, even though Black women might have been disproportionately represented, for millions of women across this country. And of course, especially Black women who were treated worse than white women. They got less money, less payouts than white women, even when they had more children, generally speaking. Even today, we know that studies have shown that in states where a higher percentage of Black women relative to their population in the country is on welfare, those states receive lower payments, lower welfare payments. Those women from those states, it's fascinating. And what they do is they try to collect the money from the men. They actually make mothers today sue their husbands or the fathers of their children, sue them. And so it sets up a divisive relationship between parents, sue them in order to receive welfare benefits. In some cases, mothers don't even want to put the father's name on the birth certificate so they can say, I don't know who the father is. This is how Black men often are disappearing in the numbers. I don't know who the father is, where he is. And so they can get some support from the father and still get the welfare benefits. Some people see that as cheating, but when we look at how low the benefits are, they're trying to get by. They're actually trying to beat a system that is beating them in many respects. And the beating really begins, Mikhail, with the 10 plus generations of slave labor that was never paid. And so the lack of transgenerational wealth that families, that Black families have to suffer with, and then find themselves at the mercy of the state with these austere sexist policies. They're misogynoir and they're misandry noir because they also police and violate Black men's sexual rights as well. I mean, during the 60s, when these policies were in full force, basically, Black women couldn't have any sexual relationships. Black women couldn't have love relationships. If a male friend visited and a social worker happened to be come by, it was assumed that this was the substitute father. It was just a horrendous situation. And as much as those payments helped Black families, the entire system that wrapped them up in policing and violation and intrusion and embarrassment and punishment was just as harmful as what it would have meant in many cases to not even have the benefits. And that's why some mothers even went off welfare. Said, I don't want this. I don't want you violating my privacy. I don't want this. I'll find a way.
Thank you. And it's very important and very heavy, heavy stuff that we're dealing with and, you know, you're discussing right now. And so earlier you also talked about colorism. And so the next question is, how has skin complexion and colorism and phenotypic stratification affected the Black marriage market?
It really has. And I hope that we can find more research to get a sense of what's happening now. But still, a pretty recent study from 2009 showed that Black women who are fair complexion, particularly between the ages of 20 and 29, who are fair complexion, have a 50% chance of being married, are twice as likely to be married when compared to dark complexion Black women. And they're 17% more likely to be married when compared with medium complexion Black women. What we also know is that Black men marry twice as much outside of the race overall. And it's been hard to really gather this statistic, at least for me. I've done a lot to get it, but I think I got it into the very end of the book in a footnote or an endnote, I should say. It appears that Black men in the middle, upper middle classes marry three times as much outside of the race than Black women. So that is a very interesting development when you think about it. Perhaps many of them have more opportunities to socialize with non-Black women. And they are choosing oftentimes racially ambiguous women, non-Black women, white women. And so Black men are, but keep in mind, still, most Black men who marry are marrying Black women. I mean, a lot of times we want to blow that number out of proportion. Most who marry are marrying Black women, and we do have to remember that. But colorism does affect Black male desire, Black male heterosexual desire. I know it's also rampant in the LGBTQ community because I've just been getting earfuls, at least anecdotally. I know it is major. I actually teach about that in the Black Love course. And so we're dealing with a very, very painful issue. I mean, when you have, I have stories in my book in chapter 5 where very, very dark skinned women, men are telling Black women who are maybe their complexion or even maybe a little lighter, oh, I don't date dark skinned women. I only date light skinned women. Wow. Wow. What does that say about how you value yourself, perhaps your mother, perhaps women in your community? But the question is, you know, how do we get this way? And we know that it began in slavery. The truth is, this society rewards fair skin. This society, for far too long, and these kinds of structures were replicated in our own communities with brown bag tests and other kinds of regulations and criteria that locked dark complexion people out of opportunities. And apart from the issue of how beauty is constructed and how desire might be related to how beauty is constructed, when there are more material and social rewards for people with lighter skin. People will more likely want to gravitate toward those rewards. So there are those kinds of implications as well, because of the kind of material and social rewards. People are going to want to privilege the people who are most valued socially and who receive those material rewards.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for that. And so that goes into my next question. How does class, wealth, and financial stability, how does that also affect the Black marriage market?
It's very important. One of the things I learned, I tried to look for research on what Black men think about marriage. I mean, we like to talk about marriageability and, oh, these men are not marriageable. And we like to do that. But really, what is marriageable? So I did look, and we don't have a lot. We don't have a lot of research on Black men and marriage. Dr. Armand Perry has done some fabulous work also with Derek Brooms that I was able to cite that was really helpful. And in one of their studies, they showed that across hundreds of Black women and men, what they found was that Black men and women are equally looking for partners that can bring them into the middle class or lift them higher within it. And when you think about the fact that for every dollar a white family has, a Black family has a dime in wealth, you know, what we're trying to do is compensate for lack of wealth through salary, right? We're trying to use marriage as a way to compensate for our lack of wealth. And that's never a sure fire way to provide resources for oneself and one's family. Everybody needs wealth resources to fall back on. So think about this. The Black men making $30,000 a year are looking for Black women making $55,000 a year. And guess what? Those Black women are looking for Black men making $75,000, $80,000 a year. And so we're missing each other in a sense, right? So that's also impacting the Black marriage market, because one of the things we should know is that Black people, when we do marry, we marry much later. We marry much later than our white counterparts and even other racial ethnic counterparts in America. And so it's interesting, Mikhail. I never knew that I would end up with this recommendation. I just had no idea that this is where I would end up when I started the research for the book. But the most important recommendation I have three of them, is that we must turn a corner on inherited poverty and wealthlessness in our community if we're going to impact positively the rates of marriage, of healthy marriage among Black couples or among Black people. We have to deal with that. People do not feel ready. And this is true across American society, across race and ethnicity. People do not feel ready when they don't have education under their belt oftentimes, when they don't have wealth building resources that are transgenerational, or that they can rely on in emergency situations or to build their early lives. And the stressors that come with lack of wealth, lack of a decent income, absolutely erode the health and wellness of marriages. And so Black marriages are incredibly vulnerable as a result of Black wealthlessness in America.
Thank you so much for that. And so you had a section in your book that I felt was extremely fascinating. You talked about Western patriarchy's effect on the Black marriage market. And you kind of clear up some misconceptions about African patriarchy versus Western patriarchy. So could you talk a little bit more about this and how it impacts Black love and Black marriage?
Yes. Well, the first thing I wanted to say was that we often seem to understand and own patriarchal structures and traditions as our own. In fact, as Black people, in fact, we associate them with divine authority and sanction. And because we are often very faithful, religious people, over 79% of Black people identified as Christian in some of our recent surveys. So because of that, and we want to be faithful to God's word, and we often believe that patriarchal marital institution is also biblically revealed in God's word. We really believe that this is our culture. It's our spiritual culture. It's our culture, but it is not. It actually is not. When we look at marital cultures in Africa and African patriarchy, first of all, African forms of patriarchy, which are structural, can be structural, and especially if we're trying to look at pre-colonial Africa, which is tough. It's kind of tough to separate things now that, you know, the intrusion of Islam, which is came with a lot of patriarchal traditions and customs, and also Christian colonialism, Euro-Western Christian colonialism, also inculcated incredible, you know, kind of Western patriarchal structures in Africa. But one of the things we know is that African patriarchy was not unchallenged by matriarchal, matricentric, matrifocal institutions. It had to live in tandem with, it had to compete with, it was in competition with these kinds of institutions. And that's why some social scientists who do work on African family formation and social formation, social arrangements, argue that seniority is the principle for social organization, not gender, as it seems to be in Western societies. And this is why it's so important to know who's a boy and who's a girl in the West. It's not as important in many African societies to know that, because girls are property and boys inherit property. When we look at the history of Western thought, philosophy, laws, it's democracy, it practices public and private domains. This is totally unheard of in Africa. We have women who were captured into slavery from parts of Africa who were hundreds of miles from their homes because they were trading. Women have always been public and public figures and always held public offices in African society. So it's a very different reality, very different marital structures in Africa. What happened after slavery, African descendants had developed their own courtship arrangements and terms like sweethearting and taking up. You know, sweethearting, kind of the dating phase where everyone knows that this couple is getting to know one another, taking up. They also had their own notions for long distance marriages, sometimes calling them trial marriages. Very interesting. They're different marital and coupling arrangements. And after slavery, missionary societies and institutions, educational institutions that were created for Blacks at the collegiate level, like institutions like Fisk, for example, and the federal government, right, through bureaucratic structures, inculcated Black people into marriage customs that were Euro-Western and patriarchal, and did that through Christian educational materials, through labor laws. Black women who were working in regions where tenant farming was practiced could not get contracts unless they were married. I mean, there were very few exceptions. And the idea of the ideal marriage was a dyad couple, a man and a woman, so monogamous man and a woman, dyad couple, and upon marriage, the woman would take the husband's names, which did not happen in Africa. Women didn't lose their names. And the husband would be responsible for all finances for the household, all labor contracts. So for example, even with the labor contracts, husbands were responsible for that. All labor contracts for wives and children, anything that had to do with property. This was called the doctrine of coverture in Euro-Western marital laws, where the woman basically loses her identity. I mean, she becomes his helpmate, she becomes his wife, and he handles has the ultimate authority figure for any kind of contract related business, any kind of inheritance, those kinds of issues. The man is responsible for them, has ultimate authority, etc. I mean, certainly there were workarounds, and eventually, even in the 19th century, America kind of, you know, American marriages began to abandon the doctrine of coverture, but Black couples after slavery were socialized into this view that marriage is a patriarchal institution, that the man is the head of the household. That is a mute concept in Africa, totally un-African, this head of household concept. And therefore, as the patriarch, it is his responsibility to provide for his family. The wife is to be the ultimate domestic and take care of the children. And this was seen as God's plan. Scriptures were quoted and used to justify these kinds of marital and family arrangements. And this is totally Euro-Western. We don't see anything like this replicated in Africa. We don't see any such thing replicated in Africa until the imposition of modern colonial, and even still, it has not destroyed indigenous African forms of marriage and family formation. So the head of household concept, the patriarchal responsibility of men to be the breadwinners. So we have a lot of people today believing, well, he needs to have this amount, six figures. He needs to have this to take care of me. And this, even if I work, my salary is supplemental. What is that? Where did that come from? For Black people, as people with very little to no wealth, can we afford that? Can we even afford that? How reasonable do we think it is to expect that Black men, most Black men, can achieve that kind of financial independence in order to fulfill those criteria? So I ask my readers to take another look at where those criteria came from, where this idealization of the patriarchal nuclear family came from, and to raise questions about the diverse family forms and coupling arrangements that we have had in our community from Africa, even to America. What happens, Mikhail, is that they're most prominent among working class. I've always wondered if they might even be prominent among very, very upper class Black people, because sometimes you have to really have your kin group. And when you have a lot of wealth and money, you got to be protect one another within your own kin group. So I've always wondered if someone did a study amongst the richest Blacks, if we would see similar family arrangements. But by and large, they tend to exist among the working class and poor, these very very flexible, I should say, family arrangements, and which are more Africana oriented, and they've been demonized and pathologized since the Morning Report in 1965, and as the ideal family form is shown everywhere, from television commercials to television shows to magazines to the church and other religious institutions. They've been pathologized, but I think we need to revalue many of those family forms and think about what our community needs as a result of forbidden Black love.
For sure. Thank you so much. And so how do you propose we combat some of these concepts, such as heads of households and for the Black community, but then also dilemmas, as you mentioned in your book, absent strong fathers?
Yes, that's really interesting. First of all, it's a dilemma because it's a trope and it's a label. Absent strong fathers, it's a trope and it's a label that has been imposed on us. That first, the strong father is a present father. And I don't disagree that being present, showing up for your children every day is critical. But what we have not often accounted for is, for example, and this was so widespread, and I'm so glad that I still see feature stories on it. In 2013, the CDC did a major study that indicated that Black men spend more quality time with their children than white and Latino men. And there was such shock from so many people. One of the things we don't often take into consideration is how present many fathers are in the lives of their children, especially from 0 to 5. Maybe these relationships don't often last, or maybe other things move, create alienation between fathers and their children. But just because fathers are not in the household doesn't mean that they're not influencing their children's lives. So first of all, we need to look seriously at whether and how fathers could be and are influencing their children's lives, whether they're in the household and vice versa, if the father is the primary child care provider, are the mothers in their children's lives. The second thing, I'm reminded of Carol Stack's study from the 1970s, where she studied a community, she called it a community in the ghetto. She didn't say where it was. It might have been Chicago. And what she showed is there was no concept of the single Black mother. It just didn't apply. I mean, certainly people would have wanted it to. I mean, you had adolescents giving birth at 16, 17, 18. You had that happening, 15. But they were never alone. The family networks, they had uncle coming through and auntie coming through and this friend who was godfather coming through. And these communities had full-fledged networks of support and care for the children that were being born in these kin networks. The concept of single family was not relevant. The concept of head of household really wasn't relevant. Oftentimes it was a mother, but oftentimes the fathers were involved with the children, even if they didn't share the same household or were not married. Fascinating. So I think one of the things we have to do is examine the different kinds of family formation that we have. We have had them since the end of slavery. And because they've been pathologized, we've tried to imitate the nuclear patriarchal family. And even, white America is realizing that that was a mistake, the nuclear patriarchal family. They're realizing that when you isolate individuals, when you isolate couples and basically say, you've got to do this alone, nobody wins. So larger kin networks, valuing those networks of support that we have developed as Black people, the, play cousins and the auntie cousins and all of these people who might not even be blood relatives, but they are relatives, that matters. And I think it's time to reinvest in that kind of relationship building and asserting those relationships for what they can do in terms of supporting adults to support one another and the children in our lives. I think that's important. First, value the diversity of those kin networks, investigate them, look at how well they're working for us. But again, another thing that we have to be attentive to is I say this in the book, we can't have kin wealth without financial wealth, without wealth resources to back up that kin wealth. Because what happens as we're dealing with so many first gens going off to college and getting master's degrees and other professional degrees, what happens is what social scientists call wealth spread. And that one person has to hold up the whole kin group. And that is extremely stressful. So we celebrate kin wealth, for what it can do for us in terms of support, not just material resources, but also inner, internal resources, emotional, psychological resources. But also that must be paired with financial wealth. We can't have kin groups without the financial wealth backing that it needs. And people of African descent in this country deserve reparations for the wealth that was stolen from them so that they can build wealth today for their communities and families.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. Stewart. And so tell us, why is it important to discuss Black marriage and Black love? And ultimately, what do you hope readers gain, especially Black women and Black men, after reading your book?
Yes. One, I want to change a national conversation about love, coupling, and marriage in our community. I want us to develop more empathy for one another as Black women and men. I want us to give some attention, not as much or not immediately, not first, to what we have done, particularly the harmful and toxic things that we have done. Not first, but I want us to first give attention to what has been done to us, to the harmful and toxic things that have been done to us. Some people might ask, you know, are you saying that we're not responsible for our actions, for what we do, for when we don't show up for our children, for when we abandon our families? Absolutely, we are. We absolutely are. There's no doubt about it. But if we only try to approach this topic from a personal self-help, a personal responsibility perspective, we will never address it at the numbers that we need it to be addressed. Do you think what we don't often acknowledge is that those kinds of behaviors are often symptoms of grave structural and systemic problems? They are Black people and or people in general, but in this case, we're talking about Black people trying to cope in unhealthy ways with being under-resourced, over-policed, under-educated, under-hired in terms of gainful employment, trying to cope in often the ways that are accessible to them, unhealthy, maybe ways that have been criminalized by our system, ways that create alienation between them and their families. I just want to know, if Black folks had the advantages that white folks had from land grants right after slavery, with Abraham Lincoln's land grants that were given to white immigrants coming into this country, all the way to the GI Bill that created a booming middle class and upper class in terms of wealth for the average white American, all the way to policies that favor white families in terms of tax policies and regulations. If Black people had those kinds of advantages along the way, didn't have to deal with redlining, didn't have to deal with racist mortgage lending and predatory mortgage lending, if Black people just had all of the white privileges that are accorded, do we think we would be seeing so-called absent fathers, we would be seeing at the levels that we see it? That's why I'm interested in systemic and structural approaches, because I think we will see less of that. Every community, every people across the world have depressed people, have people who just don't, you know, want to be motivated, can't be motivated for whatever. Every community has that. There's no community that doesn't have that. And those people need to work on themselves too. You know, hopefully they can get the resources to do it. But what we're often seeing are symptoms of structural problems where people, out of desperation and lack of access to the resources they need, turn to antisocial or unhelpful or toxic modes of navigating a treacherous and traumatic experience of being involuntarily present in America as descendants of enslaved people. That's what we really see. And I want us to spend some time dealing with that and taking that seriously, and not just looking at the romantic aspects of love and marriage. and saying to ourselves, what happens when we put Black love, marriage, and family formation at the center of every policy decision, at the center of every issue that we're fighting for? We're going to address everything. We're going to address maternal health and mortality rates, health disparities, education, incarceration. We're going to address everything when we put it at the center. And I want us to have those conversations for just a moment, rather than, he did this and she did that and you need to do this and you need to do. I just want to put that on pause for 1 second and realize that things have been done to us that have been unfair, that have been structural, and that have deeply impacted our ability to find healthy, sustaining love and coupling and marriage, right? Not everybody wants to marry, but for those who do, and marriage. And that's how I want to change the conversation, to not depress people, but to say, if we don't look at what the problems are, how can we change it? How can we change it? So that's what I want us to do, to take seriously these four pillars of forbidden Black love and others that we identify, and come up with agendas. For those who are activists, what are you going to do in your corner of the world? For those who are educators, how are we going to bring these matters to the fore so that people understand them and can digest them and that and can make a difference, right? I've had many white readers, Asian readers, readers who are not Black, just be totally floored and like, oh my goodness, I have learned so much. I never understood. I never knew. This is incredible. Let me just end with this, because I wanted to share just a few stats, and I'm not just the stats of who was married, at time of survey. And by the way, it was 29.4 married in 2010, and the 2020 census is 28.5 Black women, so married at time of survey. So we're not in a better position, right? In 2019, what the survey says is 28.5. But there are some census data that emerge in these U.S. Census Bureau reports that I've been paying attention to as well, that continue to kind of look at what happens in between the decennial census. So for 2016, and this is what concerns me, for 2016, and 25 to 29, you're not as worried, but in 2006, 70.2 percent of Black women had never been married between 25 and 29. By 2016, it's 79%. And when, let's look at the years where Black women, okay, finally have like this last opportunity if they want to have children with their spouses. Let's look at 35 to 44. But 2006, 36.9 had never been married. So this has nothing to do with the women who are married at time of survey. We had never been, and remember, Black women get divorced at a much higher rate as well. So this is not telling us how many people are married. How many have never been married? 36.9. So the other 73%, just because they had been married doesn't mean that 50% of them are not divorced and unmarried right now. Do you see where I'm going with that? Okay, so 36.9. But by 2016, it's 44.1 who have never been married a decade later. The percentages just keep going up. And when we compare that, for example, to white women, it's 12.8 in 2006 and only 16.8 compared to our 44.1 between the ages of 35 and 44 who'd never been married. Look at Asian women, it's 11.8 in 2006 and 13. They're even doing better than white women, right? So we stand out way, way beyond. For Latinos, they're still doing much better than us. They're twice as much. They're 16% who had never been married, whereas we're 36.9 in that age group and 22% who had never been married in 2016, and we're at 44.1%. So it is an issue for the Black women who want to be married. And I know that is millions of us, right? Millions of Black women want to be married to Black men, and there's nothing wrong with that. People should, I think, marry whom they love. There's no doubt about it. But telling Black women to marry and date out of the race does not solve the ultimate problem, and does not solve the problem for Black women who want to be married to Black men.
Dr. Stewart, thank you so much for writing this powerful, though heavy, but definitely powerful work. And so that brings us to my last question. What are you working on next?
Well, several books, because I'm a scholar in that way. I love researching and writing. But in relation to this topic, when I wrote this book, and it was really hard to grapple with all of the pain and the trauma that I had to make visible for us to understand the structural violence that we had experienced with regard to our marriage and family and coupling relationships. I said, I will never write another book like this. I just want to write this for my community, especially to change a conversation, to open it up, to see if we can really impact the structures and systems through activism and having Black people put love and marriage and coupling on the civil rights agenda. We're excellent at civil rights, right? But what has happened is I've learned more things about what's happening now. Black women's divestment movement from Black men. Okay, you all don't want to marry us? Fine. We're going to divest from you. I am curious. I really want to talk about that divestment movement. All of the kind of ads and television commercials that are promoting this interracial image of interracial relationships, especially Black-white relationships, right? Especially Black man-white woman, promoting that everywhere. I mean, if you look at these commercials, you would think 80% of Black couples are married to a white person and maybe 10% to an Asian person. And that is absolutely not the case. No matter what we say about Black men marrying twice as much outside the race or three times as much, most Black men still marry Black women. Period. And we're not seeing that. I want to talk about those issues. I want to talk about family formation a little bit more. I want to delve more into the diverse, flexible family forms and raise questions about patriarchal marriage. I feel that we need to deal with, especially the biblical foundations of it. This is where my expertise can come in. I mean, I'm not a biblical scholar, but as a scholar of religion and theology, I really want to open up what I started in chapter 5 and really take people, situate my readers in that first century empire where the Christians are dealing with empirical formation, right? And dealing with the pressures of what it means to live under empire and try to escape notice so that you won't be fed to wild animals, right? This is not a dominant religion. This is a marginal religion. And they're trying to survive in this culture by not being seen. And we now are taking what they were doing to try to survive as our blueprint for how we need to live today. Has nothing to do. They weren't writing a manual for all time. So I really want to walk my readers through that and help them understand what was going on in their relationship with their God, right? And in their social experiment with, or experience, I should say, with empire. And so I want to take that on. People are asking for more with regard to that. And a couple other issues. I've been hearing about the passport bros as well. Issues about what it means for Black men now to say we're going overseas. We're looking for Brazilian women and women from Thailand and other Caribbean women, because African-American women or Black women generally, right? When I say Caribbean, I'm thinking like Dominican, Puerto Rican, etc. African-American women generally are too harsh, are not desirable, are not going to be the most compliant wives, etc., etc. So I want to kind of deal with some more contemporary issues that my readers are asking for, and some of these issues around patriarchal marriage in a Black love too. I don't know what it will be called yet, but my goal is to have the book finished by the end of 2024.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing. And I look forward to reading Black Love too, for sure. Yes, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast and speaking with us today about your book, Black Women, Black Love. Definitely recommend to audiences. Thank you again, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mikhail. It was a pleasure to be with you.